dynamic spin form models, asymptotic dynamics. Frank?
Thank you, George. I'd like to speak about recent work with Benjamin Barr, Bianca Bittrich, and Wojciech Kaminski that was done mostly here at the Albert Einstein Institute from my side and from Bianca and Wojciech's side and with Benjamin Barr from Cambridge. Using a holonomy formulation of spin form models to learn more about the dynamics, about the dynamics content of these theories in general. So if you want to switch to slide two, please. The papers that this is about, one of them is out, that's kind of like laying out the general groundwork for the formulation that we're going to be using and investigate their coarse graining with some numerical methods. Also, it lays out the context, the relationship to other holonomy formulations of spin form models that's been used throughout the years. The other two papers should be out soon. One will deal with the canonical dynamics that we can get from them, at least some first steps and the boundary Hilbert spaces, and the EPRL type asymptotic dynamics of EPRL type models. The work of Kaminski is coming out. A little soon plus-ish. That's going to be the most what I will talk about will focus on the third aspect, but I will touch on the other aspects as well. Of course, as you probably all are familiar with, spin form models have a long, rich history. Many people have worked on them in the last roughly 15 years. There's a prehistory going back before that. And if you switch to slide three, throughout this history, holonomies have been, like holonomy formulations, holonomy variables have been very, connection variables have been useful and fruitful in their study. I should also have added on the last point on this, the recent work by Bianchi and then Claudio, Eugenio Bianchi and Claudio Zerini, that used holonomy formulation similar to ours, but really the list goes back to the original definitions of the F theory in all dimensions that was done via auxiliary field theory, the early works of Reisenberg and Govelli, to later all these, then in the 2000s work to derive the Barrett-Crane model and get formulations of that. In particular, there's a formulation by Paris and Govelli that's very close to what I'll be showing you in a second. And the new work on group field theories and the definition, the precise definition of the Pontano-Reggi model in three dimensions in the last few years. So it's not the holonomies in itself that's anything new here. But if you switch to slide four, then you can see holonomies themselves are nothing new. We have been looking at a particular formulation that we came up on in while looking for formulation that's suited for various tasks. And we actually came up with the same formulation looking for various different things. It's a formulation that's based on two distributions, E and delta, that I will introduce to you in more detail in a few slides. And it makes a maximum number of structural assumptions, which leaves us with a minimal number of parameters. In particular, the entire content of the model is encoded in just the choice of one distribution, E. This encodes the simplicity constraint, and it's a distribution in one group variable that covers everything. That this is really a strong structural assumption. You can see from the fact that the KKL model, for example, is not covered. Not all models are covered in that, but it's covered in a reasonable way. It covers a reasonable breadth of models that have been explored so far. One of the advantages that this formulation has is that there's a natural current boundary space for all these models, so we no longer need to separate boundary spaces for different models, but we can study them all in the same boundary space. In the same way, we can look at this choice of e-function as parametrizing the space of models that we want to actually investigate in a renormalization context. We get an immediate generalization to finite groups by taking the analog of this parameter space, of this space of models in finite groups, and I'll be talking a little bit more about that later. And finally, we can study the composition of these distributions, the E's and the deltas, in this integration, in this convolution product. And if you do this, we find that it's, of course, ill-defined as expected, but it's also very geometric. And we can use tools from distribution theory to really study the precision function on the whole. If we do that, then if you go to slide 5, we find, as I just said, the partition function is not well-defined due to a product of delta functions. It's very much just reminiscent of the situation that we have in the Ponsano-Reggie model. The problem are configurations that allow for arbitrary large bivectors inside finite boundaries. That's, again, very much as we already intuitively expected. Now, doing this all, we find actually that we can confirm the results from Valentin-Bonson from the effect that these models suffer from a flatness problem. It seems that any regularization that we can choose for the models that include the Mirfi parameter and which preserves the geometricity of the connection is flat, except for some accidental theorems. The only model that seems fine at the moment, so we haven't actually shown that either, is that the Fredal Kerfner model without Mirfi parameter. And, you know, this formulation actually allows us to go further. It kind of helps our geometric intuition because this convolution product of distributions is so geometric. It allowed us to really identify the origin of the flatness problem and give a proposal for how to fix it. And I'll be getting to that towards the end of my talk today. Now,
What does it mean to say that the model is flat? Can you just explain that?
I'll get to the precise statement later. Basically, if you're familiar with the work of Valentin-Bonson, his statement was that in the geometric, if you have geometric configurations on the interior, all these have to correspond to flat geometries. Not all configurations are geometric, but the geometric ones have to be flat geometries. But I'll get to the precise statement later.
Okay. Another question. Could you briefly say why the KKL model is not included?
What I've been talking about in this talk. So let's get to the meat.
Sorry, I have another question here.
Let's go to slide number 6.
Yes, I just wanted to. Can you briefly say why is the KKL model not included?
I'll be able to show you that as well in 2 slides.
Okay.
Okay. So now, on slide 6, I'm actually going to tell you what this formula that is just flashed in the last 2 slides actually means. So the setup is the usual one, if you're familiar with spin forms, of a 2 complex, which we will usually take to be dual to a triangulation of a 4 manifold here. This 2 complex is decorated with a bunch of group elements. These are associated to pairs of edges and vertices and pairs of edges and faces whenever the 2 of them are adjacent. We take the convention that GEV is the inverse of GBE, so we can take an ordered product around a face. So each edge has 4 faces incident on it, that's from the combinatorics of the triangulation. So each edge has 4 GEFs associated to it and 2 GEVs for the 2 vertices and the 2 faces that are near it. Now if you go around one of this face, each face has a fiducial order and a fiducial start vertex. If you go around the face, you can take 2 products of group elements. One is the one that includes the GEF, and the other is the one that just has the GBEs. Now, in what is to come, the GBEs will take the role of the parallel transport from the vertex to the middle of the edge and back, and the GEFs play a different geometric role, not that of a connection a priori. So I want to call the GBEs the connection, really the connection degrees of freedom, and the GEFs will be the simplicity rotations, the names which I will come later. So taking the normal holonomy around the face is just a product of the GBEs, which I denote G tilde F, whereas the product of all group elements associated to the face is actually called GF. Now the first ingredient of the partition function is just the delta of this GF, the delta function of this GF. If I would now just drop the GEF, I would go back to just the Pontano-Reggie model on this two complex. I can do that by choosing the E function to be a delta function. The delta function just puts all the GEFs to their identity, and we see already that in the, this partition function has a special case, it's BF theory, simple, usual BF theory. If I now allow the GEF to differ away from flatness, from the identity, I'm also allowing the holonomy, G tilde F, the connection, degrees of freedom, G tilde F, to vary away from the identity that's otherwise enforced by the delta function on the space in BF theory. So we already see that this convolution, this, the E distribution here plays a role very much like what we expect simplicity to be. The E distribution has to satisfy certain relations. So first of all, it has to be even under inverse. That is such that the fiducial orientation of the face does not matter. And furthermore, it has to be conjugation invariant under the subgroup. And this is actually the only place where the subgroup that's so important, the SE2, the diagonal SE2 or the stabilizing SE2, that's so crucial in the EPRL model enters. It's actually the only role, the only place where it enters in the construction. You can already see that this is kind of a very nice general case. The conditions on E are very straightforward. You can immediately see when the model is real. You have this kind of independence from the fiducial orientation that's kind of hard to see for general, what it implies for general groups and the spin picture kind of immediately dropping out. So it's already a formulation that's kind of elegant, minimalistic, simple while capturing a lot of the structure that we want from the spin form model, which is why kind of we found it a very useful one. From now on, I'm going to focus exclusively on spin form and SE2, except when I mention otherwise. But yeah, so this is the formula that we're looking at. This is the model that we've been studying. The formulation of the model that we've been studying. Now, if you go to slide 7, I can show you why this is actually equivalent to the EPRL model, and I can also explain to you why the KKL condition, why the KKL construction does not satisfy all the properties needed or encoded in this partition function. So slide 7. Here I'm giving you a brief graphical representation of a calculation that you can do in order to get to this holonomy formulation from the standard vertex picture. In the standard vertex picture and each edge, you're gluing two SE2 intertwiners. I'm specifying two EPRL for the second, by the way. We're just gluing two EPRL intertwiners. These EPRL intertwiners are constructed by taking an SE2 intertwiner iota in a representation K, or a set of representations K, injecting them with a map I row K into the spin 4 representation row, and then group averaging in the large group. That's the projected PV. So the double strands here signify large, a representation of the large group, single strand small group, and we sum over the basis of intertwiners. Now we can replace the sum over the basis of intertwiners simply within group averaging over the subgroup. That's what the basis of intertwiners is. It's a, in writing out on the basis, the projection on the invariant subspace. This, because the group, because the injection maps I row k are subgroup covariant, they're covariant under the diagonal SE2 subgroup, we can actually absorb this pH projector into the PG projector that we already have from before. So this is the step from the lower left to the lower right. Going back up, to the top right, we can simply Fourier transform this injection map or introduce a resolution of the identity there by introducing a new group element per strand. Each of these strands corresponds to a phase in the two complex. Now you have we have two representations of the of spin four here, row prime and row, and we can sum these independently. One of them has this injection map in it, summing that provides us with a function e, that's the function of one, that's the function e, which is the function of one group element pg, which occurs in the projector pg. And the other one on the row prime simply gives us a delta function on the phase. So by doing this, we obtain this e function formulation of the this e function holonomy formulation. Here you can see why this does not hold for KKL. KKL modifies this by taking, instead of a projector on the subgroup, a projector on the space spanned by, well, instead of taking a projector, instead of taking a sum over intertwinement, we take a sum and we take the projection onto the span of these spin four intertwiners. This construction no longer factorizes in this way. It no longer factorizes according to phase. It's now really a construction that requires all four phases at the same time. Because we don't have this factorization property, at least not in the straightforward way anymore, we cannot, in a simple way, simply localize the simplicity per edge phase combination. The simplicity remains localized on the edge only. So we cannot do this last Fourier transform that simplifies the structure here to a delta function on the phase, convoluted with a local function, with a function of only one group element. We could take a more complicated holonomy formulation, so that wouldn't be a problem, but then we would get immediately into a much larger space. I hope that kind of gives you a flavor at least of the answer. Actually, the question in detail, whether it's really impossible to find such a factorization, is hard. We know for examples where it's not possible to find such a factorization, even in just three valent cases, and we expect it's impossible, but it's actually kind of hard to prove, or at least not completely straightforward to prove that such a factorization is impossible for KKL. I hope that answers the question. So if we go on to slide 8, that's just writing out in formulas for you what the EPRL E function or the E distribution for the EPRL case is. This is of course similar to many distributions that also appear in the group theory literature and in other holonomy formulations. What's interesting for us is that this immediately, as I said before, suggests generalizations to arbitrary and in particular finite groups. We're interested in finite groups because we can study them numerically, and we can see numerically that how they behave under coarse graining. As opposed to a simple cutoff, they have the advantage that you retain the topological fixed points in the model. That's the F theory for finite groups that of course exists and is well defined. So this has many advantages for renormalization, for numerical renormalization.
So am I right in thinking that question?
Sorry?
So am I correct in thinking that if you are really interested just in the either the spin 4 or the Lorentz RSL2C, Lorentz sector, then this is quite equivalent to EPRL model. So I don't really gain anything more in those cases. Oh, sorry?
So it's just a different formulation of EPRL.
Right. So
it's not a new model.
Right. So therefore, the main advantage is what you had just had on slide 8. Is that correct? That in fact, it sort of naturally incorporates finite groups, and therefore, you might be able to.
That's one advantage. I'll get to the other advantages later.
One at a time.
I'm not saying there's anything magical about this formulation. It's a formulation we found useful for several things. Some of them could be done in outlier formulations, some maybe not so much. So here, What the straightforward generalization is that this is a distribution. When we go to finances, we don't have distributions, but we can mimic them by taking the characteristic functions on the critical manifold, or what is the equivalent of the critical manifold. Now, if you go to slide 9, I've summarized for you what the critical manifolds are in the different models. In the case of BF theory, the critical manifold is just identity. As I said before, if the E function is just a delta function on the identity, then all the new structure drops out, and we go back to BF theory. In the Barrett-Crane model, it's also very simple. It's just a subgroup H. In the EPRL and Friedel-Crossman models, it's a little bit more complicated. We have these kind of twisted, simple group elements. But they can be understood as taking a single subgroup, a U1 subgroup of spin 4, of a certain structure, and then looking at the image of the joint action of the subgroup on this. And these are all constructions that immediately generalize to finite groups. So obviously the BF series, that's just a Dijkstra-Witten model that's well known, we get finite groups very trained. That's also very immediate and very nice. And the real prize here, what we were struggling with for a while to actually get a plausible candidate, is that we get a plausible candidate for the EPRL and the Friedel-Crossman model, which is that you take a cyclic subgroup of your finite group and look at the adjoint orbits of this cyclic subgroup. That then provides you a generalization of EPRL to arbitrary groups, where the immunity parameter is replaced by a cyclic subgroup. And you can study how this behaves under coarse graining and so on. So the first results there are non-trivial. Sorry. There are non-trivial fixed points on hierarchical lattices. That's to be expected. On hierarchical lattices, you don't get non-localities. You don't switch on new degrees of freedom. So the model kind of has to go somewhere. It runs into a couple of fixed points, but it's still interesting to see just how frequent they actually are. The other thing that we see when we look at the renormalization flow there is that the models really like to flow to BF theory. Whether that's a good thing or not, we're not entirely sure, I would say. It just means that we need to be careful when we interpret the usual EPRL amplitude, since the effective amplitudes for many simplices are likely to look much more BF-like than the bare action, than the bare amplitude. Now, the second big advantage of writing everything in terms of distributions is that you can use this theory of distributions on curved manifolds that's been developed in the context of the renormalization theory of quantum field theory on curved space-time. In order to say something about these distributions. Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
So just a quick question. When you talk about these non-trivial fixed points, do you think it is reasonable to expect that the results hold also when you go back to Lie groups or not?
I should emphasize that these are only on hierarchical lattices. So it's like you take a simplex and you subdivide it very centrically over and over. You do one four moves over and over. So in that way, you can't get arbitrarily much. You don't get kind of new boundary behavior. So it's a very restricted sense in which it holds. Do I expect it to hold? To be honest, I'm not sure. I don't know if Benjamin is listening, and maybe he has a better intuition about this. He's been working more on this recently. Apparently not. So I'm going to venture and say that I think it's quite possible that you'll find something, simply because you're more or less in a compact space, and you're flowing in the compact space, so you kind of can hope to get fixed points just from the general fixed point theorem for flows on compact spaces. Sorry.
Frank, if I can comment, I expect that you get many non-trivial fixed points for Lie groups.
Okay.
Does it mean non-trivial fixed points which are isolated, or a kind of a submanifold of fixed points, or do you have any idea?
So far, these are isolated fixed points. So there's, however, as Frank mentioned, there's a general thing that hierarchical lattices are very special. So actually, most of these fixed points should go away if one changes the coarse graining procedure to more general lattices. And that will give us much more important information.
Right. So, as I said, I'd like to move on to the get to the flatness part. So what we did, the other thing we did with this formulation of the model is to use the distribution theory that was developed in the context of quantum field theory on curved space, and renormalization on the quantum field theory on curved space, in order to study this convolution product of distributions that we're dealing with. If you go to page 10, there is a I introduced the key technical tool for that. That's the wavefront set of a distribution F. Roughly, what the wavefront set of a distribution F is it's just a set of phase space elements such that semi-classical states peaked on these wavefront elements are not suppressed if the momenta of the state are scaled large. In the mathematically more precise sense, that means something like you put a bump function near where you're interested and you Fourier transform the bump function and the distribution together and you look at their fall-off behavior. The difference between these intuition and this precise statement is why we can't just transport the asymptotic of coherent state behavior over into the wavefront set distribution. That's work in progress. But the geometric intuition, or the intuition that this is kind of something that gives you information about the semi-classical behavior in this particular limit of your distribution, is quite correct. If you go to page 11, these wavefront sets have some very nice properties that make them extremely useful to us. These are that if you build a distribution by multiplying group elements in the argument of another distribution, the wavefront set of the distribution of many group elements is that obtained by parallel transporting the wavefront set of the original distribution of just one group element. That is, multiplying group elements in the argument is the same as parallel transporting the wavefront set. The second interesting property of wavefront sets is that they add in a very nice way if we have a convolution product of several distributions. The distribution, the wavefront set of the convolution product of several distributions is the sum of wavefront sets of the original distribution, except that we put on the degrees of freedom or on the variables that we've integrated out, we put the condition that the cotangent vectors should sum to zero. So we get closure, we get exactly the closure condition from convolution. There's a caveat here. The second one is a multiplication of distributions, and it's of course only well defined if some properties are satisfied. And the property is in particular that if P1, P2, P3, that the exterior, the still open part of the wavefront set, are set to zero, then the stuff that we've integrated out needs also to be set to zero automatically. If that's not satisfied, we have a problem. What this corresponds to, then the distribution is not well-defined, and we need to study how to extend it to the point where it's not well-defined. This property, in essence, because the wavefront set is a linear set, or rather a conical set, in essence this means if you have a finite boundary and infinitely large stuff on the inside, or if you have zero on the boundary and finitely large stuff on the inside, cotangent vectors on the inside, the distribution is ill-defined. So this is where our divergences are going to be coming from. finally, we can actually show that these two properties that are completely generic to distributions and groups. However, for the concrete case, we were able to show that the wavefront set of the E function of the EPLL model is actually just a pair of group element and Lie algebra element, or cotangent vector, such that P is twisted simple and G is generated by a multiple of Hodge P. The multiple is not specified. It's not, so all multiples are in the wavefront set. But this is what the EPL function gives us. And here we see really that this encodes simplicity in a very direct way. So with parallel transport, closure, and simplicity, we really have all the ingredients we need in order to get the geometric content of the partition function. So if you go to page 12, this is the result of this analysis of and using the tools from the last slide on the partition function set star that I described to you before. The main statement is that for this type of coherent state in the wave, the overlap of the coherent state with the partition function is exponentially small unless the boundary state, the semi-set of the boundary state is peaked on phase-space points that are the boundary of the solution space of the equations I write down here. So the equations here are on a bunch of Lie algebra elements and group elements. The group elements are the ones introduced before. The Lie algebra elements are new here. They occur once you do all the identifications correctly in the wavefront set analysis. We have one. We have them. They're indexed by a vertex. They're indexed by a geometric location upstairs, and then some auxiliary information downstairs. So P, D, E prime in the first equation is a bivector that, or a Lie algebra element that lives at the vertex of the two complex and is indexed by two edges incident on the vertex, and so on. So we want to interpret these equations. Some of them will look familiar to you, some of them less so. In order to interpret them, we're going to go the other way. We're going to reverse engineer from a geometric configuration what equations are satisfied by the bivectors and group elements that mimic these equations, and then look at reconstruction separately. That's done on page 13, on slide 13. The first step of that is on slide 13. On slide 13, I drew for you two vertices, two four simplices that are glued on a tetrahedron. The four simplices are at V3 and V4, and they're glued on the tetrahedron at the edge E3. They're glued by the group elements, and now I'm using capital letters because I'm in SL4 now. G, E3, V4, and G, V3, E3. They glue these four simplices together. Now, the orientation preserving gluing is such that the normals of the outward facing normals of the four simplices that are associated to the tetrahedra are glued and become antiparallel in the frame of the tetrahedron in the middle, or should become antiparallel in the frame of the tetrahedron in the middle. That's why you have the two normals facing in different directions at the tetrahedron in the middle. The gray shaded object throughout is the triangle that's corresponding to the face at which we are looking. So having all these data together, we can look at what the group elements actually do. This triangle is parallel transported consistently by all group elements. They just go around and around, and everything's fine. Every great triangle is mapped to the next one. That's the first line of equations downstairs. Now the next thing to look at is the plane orthogonal to the triangle. That's the normal. In the plane orthogonal to the triangle, is where we encode the curvature that runs around this face. That's where it gets a little bit messy and a little bit interesting. Here we want to introduce the new group element GE3S. In order to mimic the equations from that we got out of the wavefront set. This group element does the following thing. Now, instead of parallel transporting the vector nv4e3 that's outward pointing in the direction of the edge that we're looking at from vertex v4, we parallel transport the vector that's outward pointing in the direction of the edge e4 that's further down the face to the frame of the tetrahedron in the middle. Now we use the group element g3f in order to rotate this to the frame, to the vector that's pointing back, that's pointed to the vector ne3v3, which comes from the outward pointing vector at the four simplex sigma v3. So the end effect of this slightly complicated sounding operation is that if we now chain these group elements together, these three group elements that are on the slide together, we actually get a very simple operation. That is, you start out, first of all, the triangle is just preserved for all of them. That's fine. In the plane orthogonal to them, what they do is we take the outward pointing normal in the direction of the face orientation. That's nv4e4 at the very right. The parallel transport is ge3v4. We get this kind of rotated normal here in the frame of the tetrahedron that's pointing straight down. We parallel transport that again with GE3S, we get this NE3V3, which is the tetrahedral frame normal of the outer pointing normal in the base direction from sigma V3. We parallel transport with the last group element, and we again get the outward pointing normal in the face direction. So at all points now, we have the outward pointing normal in the face direction, in the orientation of the face direction. If we go around the face once completely, that means we come back to the same normal we started with. If we had done this with just the GV3E3, as it's just the GVE, we would not come back to the same normal. We would come back to a rotated normal, which would be exactly the curvature that we have around the face. The curvature around the face is encoded exactly in this compensatory rotation, GE3F, we have to do in order to keep the normal always be the outward pointing normal one.
Frank? Yes? Ask a question? Frank? Yes. So, I confess I'm not following too much the details, but in your previous works with Barrett, both Euclidean and Lorentzian, you proved that the curvature of the model in the end lies in the bulk holonomies. So now, I don't know with your notation, so if you look at the wedges, you have the link holonomies and then the bulk holonomies. And in your analysis, the link holonomies did not carry the interesting information. The dihedral angle and thus also the deficit angles at the end of the day would come only from the bulk holonomies. Now the question is, are you telling us again the same thing, or are you telling us something different? And if it is different, is it consistent with your previous results?
Yes, this is consistent. I'm telling you something different. I'm telling you something about gluing many simplices together. So here, it's consistent. There is one new element relative to our old stuff. The bulk stuff from before was the GE3V4. That's the role that used to be played by our bulk variables. The new thing here is that I'm looking at the face, at the complete face. So I'm really looking at what happens if I glue up a bunch of tetrahedra around the face.
Right, but don't we know from your previous analysis that what happens when you do that is that you get the sum of the dihedral angles, which minus 2 pi corresponds to the definition of the deficit angle?
Well, I'm doing a new, this is a different analysis. The geometricities here and the underlying it are of course the same, but I'm looking at different variables here. So I'm not going to get a red reaction or deficit angles or that type of thing. I'm just looking at what kind of equations are satisfied by the data that I've defined here. Maybe this will become a little bit clearer as we go to slide 14.
I also guess you're not right. Also, maybe one point is that you're not taking any large spin limits because you don't have spins. So in that sense, your analysis is different.
Yeah, well, this is I mean, but it's different. I don't have spins, and I'm looking. I have integrated out the spins, and I'm looking at a face in itself now. I'm looking at the equations of motion around the face. We were never looking at that before. In some sense, that's like looking at the J variation. Which is exactly what Valentin pointed out. So I mean, it's more like a different perspective on Valentin's work that's more adapted to our work and kind of connects better to what we already understand. So what I was looking for here in this picture was to explain to you, if you go to slide 14, essentially the last line of slide 14, that is, why is the product, why can, even though we have curvature, the product of the GEV and the GEF around the face be the identity? As it has to be, because in our model there's the delta function there that forces it to be the identity. All the other equations we get are the ones that are familiar from, previous works on asymptotic analysis. At the edge, we have exactly that we get tetrahedra. That is, the bivectors have to be simple because they come from triangles. They have to sum to zero. We get closure. At the vertex, we get the gluing conditions and the parallel transport conditions. So you see, really, the GBE here are like the Bartholomew's in our old work. And that, if I understand correctly what you mean with Bartholomew. And on the face, we have the correct parallel transport. That is, the bivector has to be stabilized by the group elements that go around the face. But also, we have this condition that GF is should be the identity. And we get this condition exactly for this reason, that we have this additional group element GEF that compensates the dihedral rotation. And therefore allow the connection to vary away from the identity, even though the product of group elements around the face has to be the identity. This becomes somewhat clear at least.
I think it's, for me, which is coming from different perspective altogether, what you're saying does address the question of what is the difference between what you're doing and what is happening now. But I'm confused about another issue, which is complementary, which is about what you're doing now by itself. Because you started with a partition function Z, right? And then the distribution was all in E, is that correct?
No, there's a delta function as well.
What, the partition function is a delta function?
The partition function has delta functions and E's.
But partition function is not a function of C, right? So how can it have a function, how can it have a delta function on a group? I mean, you integrate everything else out.
That's correct. I mean, now I didn't write it with boundary, but you can write the partition function with boundary. So I have boundary partition function with some open group elements for boundary. Yeah.
So you are talking about delta functions at the open group elements of the boundary. Is that what you're referring to? This when you say the wavefront distribution analysis you did.
If you want to go back to the actual partition function on slide six.
Four. Six. Okay.
Four, five, or six.
Okay.
There is a product over all faces of the two complex. And
yes.
On each face of the two complex, you have a delta function.
Yes.
This is for all interior faces, or for that matter, faces that touch the boundary of any sort of faces. Yeah. This is just like in BF theory.
So you're referring to this. So I'm still confused. So then you're talking about applying the wavefront site. You're applying to this product of delta functions? Or?
Yes, product of delta functions and E functions. This convolution, yeah. I mean, I'm really applying it to the entire partition function at the end of the day is a distribution on the group elements that I've left open. So at the end of the day, my wavefront set analysis applies to the entire partition function. And I get there by composing, by building up iteratively from the wavefront set analysis of its parts, and then using the properties for the convolution product of distribution. But the final statement is really about all of them, about the final product.
Okay. But the final, again, the final partition function is a distribution on group elements at the boundaries only,
yes.
Because everything else is integrated out. Only. Therefore, the convolution set refers only to these distributions which are defined on group elements associated with the boundary. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. Maybe I understand your confusion. The statement, the precise statement is that at the boundary we get those group elements and bivectors that are the boundaries of the solutions of certain equations in the interior. So even though we've integrated out the interiors, we sort of remember that there was an interior. We remember in the fact that the statement we make about the boundary is that it's not suppressed if we are on points that are the boundary points of solutions to the following bulk equations.
Very good.
So in that sense, the statement is maybe a little bit complicated, but that's why I'm giving you constantly statements about the bulk, even though I'm actually talking about the wavefront set of the boundary. In the variables that are lit on the boundary, that's why.
That's very good. Okay, so the last question is that, I still am going back to this question about flatness problem. I mean, I don't know what the problem is still, because, you can just, right? I mean, you can have the individual simplices being flat, and the curvature being all concentrated on the faces. So is that a problem?
Can I maybe just keep going for a little bit longer until I've actually told you about the flatness problem?
Good, thank you.
Because it's coming right up. What I tried to do in the last slide was show you that the equations on slide 14 are equations satisfied by geometric data.
Good, thank you.
Where the G, F are defined as compensating the dihedral rotation, the bivectors are the geometric bivectors, the G, E, V are the connection variables, etc. Now, the problem is here, if you look at the edge, we get that BE is simple, but our model actually gets BE is twisted simple. So in order to get twisted simple equations, we go to slide 15, and we use the operator C gamma that enforces this twisting, or that introduces this twisting. Now, if we do this twisting, we get that first of all, it's invertible. That's good that it doesn't change the solution space so much. It commutes with the joint group action, which means that all the equations that are group actions or that are linear in B are unchanged, which is basically all of them, except for three, and the top right one changes into B a twisted simple, which is just what the EPRL and the FK model gives us. Then the terms of this equation down, we want also to preserve this two down, this kind of slightly lengthy technical one. But what's kind of unclear now, and which was kind of a bit annoying, is this identity on the face that we got before. That was satisfied by geometric configuration. If we twist the B, we also twisting the GEF because they are generated by the Bs, and therefore the product GF gamma that's actually GF gamma equals the identity that the product of the GEF and GEVs will change as well, and it's unclear a priori how it changes. Now, if you go to the next slide, slide 16, how does it actually change? The twisting mixes a little bit of an orthogonal bivector into the bivector that we originally had. So where CEF before was generating only a rotation, around the triangle, now it's getting a proportional rotation in the triangle, in the plane of the triangle, mixed in. Now once we go around the face, the identity condition will still set the, and would still set the, GEF to be geometric in the sense that their rotation around the bivector compensates exactly the dihedral rotation. So the product of the GEF rotations around the bivector has to be the dihedral rotation still. However, because we now also have a rotation in the triangle plane, and this rotation cannot be compensated by something, And the identity function is still putting this to zero, where inadvertently, by still imposing the delta function on the face, having gamma twisted, also forcing the dihedral rotation to be flat. And if that was too fast, I'm afraid I don't have the time to just repeat it. Maybe it's just something where you need to like think, meditate on the pictures a little bit once the paper's out. The upshot is that enforcing the condition that GF gamma is equal to 1 actually implies that the dihedral, that gamma times the dihedral rotation has to be 0 modulo 2 pi. That's the flatness problem. That's what I refer to as the flatness problem. The dihedral rotation in these models is set to almost always set to 0. This also shows that the gamma to 0 limit is actually kind of strange and potentially discontinuous. Because what you actually do is this kind of accidental zeros that you get from the rationality of gamma will start populating the line, or populating the circle. So the gamma to zero limit is probably something that one also should look at with some more care. But that's just an aside. The important thing here is that we can now see quite immediately what the correct equation should be. Instead of setting it equal to 0 by forcing Gf gamma equal to 1, we should set Gf gamma equal to the geometric rotation that that encodes the dihedral dihedral angle of theta, except twisted, so kind of the orthogonal rotation to the geometric rotation, which is what schematically the equation labels as the twisted phase equation does for you. So our proposal on slide 17 is to replace the delta function on the phase with such a with a distribution that enforces exactly this twisted phase equation. We have a proposal for doing that using a Friedel-Krasnov-like construction. However, there's a price to pay for that, and that is the delta and the partition function defined in this way actually will no longer live in any natural way in the loop quantum gravity Hilbert space. So whereas before, for the EPRL model at least, we could write down how to map it into the loop quantum gravity Hilbert space, this is no longer the case. One of the interesting things that I mentioned before, these models all come with their own, with a natural Hilbert space. This whole class of models for arbitrary E comes with a natural universal Hilbert space that's larger than the projected network space, by the way, and that has some really nice structural advantages that I won't go into any further, and that's actually preserved by this modification. Now, on slide 18, I want to say a few words, or a few more words, on the regularization of this model. Everything that I said before was sort of like ignoring this regularization, this problem of regularizing the model. One of the things that we get from this is, as I explained, what type of configurations cause the divergences. There we get the DF section, which we know to be hard to regularize, but maybe a construction a la Jonathan Englund can get rid of that for us, and we get the Diffeo factor, where we have vertex translation symmetry. And the question is, are there more? If not, then we actually might have a shot at, you know, classifying the regularization ambiguities of the model at least. And then, since it's already quite late in the hour, I'm just going to move on to the conclusions in slide 19. So, and then maybe we can have some more questions. So, first of all, let me say what's new. So we have the first analysis of the partition function without any assumptions on the interior. So we're not taking any limit on the interior. We're taking a large spin limit on the boundary, but the interior is really analyzed as is. We can then do some generalizations of this model, of the extended model, by modifying the phase weight. Now, these modifications that I just fast put to you briefly would actually be extremely hard to see in the spin picture, since they really a dramatic modification. It's a minor modification in this picture, and the spin picture that would be a dramatic modification to the partition function. We get a new boundary Hilbert space that is really very generic, has very nice structural properties, and we get One of the forthcoming papers has some initial steps of the study of the transfer operator using the stable space. But then the list of things to do is kind of long. And I think it's quite an interesting question that are opened up by this. First of all, the question is, what happens in the Lorentzian case? The flatness how does the flatness result change? In particular, what happens to the accidental zeros? There should be a natural formulation of this in terms of spinners of the wavefront set analysis, since wavefront sets actually play very nice with symplectic reduction, and our distribution theory on C2 is much simpler than on a curved manifold like a Goode manifold. There are more simplicity constraints to study, like the Bagatelle-Ogeti one that we haven't quite done yet, or the holomorphic one. Then, importantly, study how to actually make the partition function well-defined. Study how to extend the distribution to the points where it's ill-defined, and what ambiguities arise in this extension. And that would be a first step, hopefully, towards the continuum limit of these theories. So, and with that, I would like to thank you. On slide 20, as a historical reference or as a historical bracket, given you a quotation from the original paper by Barrett and Crane in 98, where they already say that the one issue which still needs to be addressed in order for the states and we are proposing to be a candidate for a quantum theory of gravity is how probability amplitudes computed with it behave as we refine the triangulation. That was the one issue that they saw 15 years ago. I think we found a few other issues in the meantime, but it's still, I think we're finally in a point where we can make a push for actually studying this in detail and studying the behavior of the entire partition function rather than just its individual building blocks. Yes. Thank you very much.
Two questions.
Frank, I want to add a couple of questions here. First, if you just go to slide 19, which is your conclusion slide. One of the generalizations is that the Hilbert space is not, the boundary space is not loop quantum gravity Hilbert space. But then you also said on, another slide, which is 17, that this Hilbert space is larger than the projective limit you will get. Is that correct? Or is that a precise statement in the sense that standard LQG Hilbert space is subspace?
It's larger than the projected spin network space, not the projected limit. I'm not taking a loop quantum gravity construction here with projected limits. I meant the projected spin network space a la Alejandro. It's larger in the sense that it's a function that you have functions of two group elements per S, and you're only reducing out some of them of the additional data by symmetries.
But to some extent, then, isn't there a tension? Because, in the interior, the construction was all motivated as to how you specify the data. Was very strongly motivated, I would say, by the loop quantum gravity Hilbert space, by the holonomy flux algebra, if you like. You are taking fluxes of Bs and holonomies. If the Hilbert, let me just start from scratch. In loop quantum gravity, one starts with holonomy flux algebra, and then the famous theorems tell us that there is a unique representation of this algebra, and that is the Hilbert space that one normally uses.
Well, all my group elements were SO4 or spin 4 to start with. So that's a discrepancy already, I think. I would, from my perspective, the data I was using is motivated by the data by using, trying to cast geometry into spin 4 and bivector language. So I think there's a certain parallelity, but it's at the same time, I'm not sure I would necessarily expect to arrive from this perspective directly at the Lucan and gravity Hilbert space without some additional work, at least. We're finding more and more that the EPRL model conditions to really match the Lucan gravity Hilbert space quite precisely in a natural way is a strong one, I think. Yeah.
But on the other hand, you did tell us in answer to an earlier question that this is not a new model. It does agree. It is the EPRL model. So I'm confused about the two statements.
If you take the modification that's on slide 17, then you use the Lucan gravity Hilbert space, and then it's no longer the EPRL model. If you don't take that modification, then your boundaries will only be non-suppressed if they're the boundaries of a flat geometry on the interior, but you get the Lucan gravity Hilbert space. Unfortunately, I don't have kind of completely good news on that. I don't know what the solution is to get kind of both.
I can comment on that. So actually, this new Hilbert space is still a Hilbert space which has holonomy and fluxes. The main point is just that these are SO4 holonomies and fluxes. It's a bit related to, for instance, the quantization which Thomas and collaborators have done, that you start with an SO4 Hilbert space. And then the question is how the simplicity constraints are imposed and whether you get down to an SU2 Hilbert space or not. But the structures are very similar to an LTG Hilbert space. It's just a question about which holonomies you consider.
That helps a lot. So if that is the case, then the statement is that there's still a holonomy flux algebra, but it just happens to be SO4. So then the question is really understanding its relation to classical general relativity. Because if all these things, the basic variables, were actually associated with SO4 or spin, SL2C in the Lorentzian sector, then it seems, at least on the face of it, that you don't really make any contact with classical general relativity. It's something else, unless you put some additional condition like simplicity or something like that. So is it possible that, I mean, obviously, whatever the new model is, you want to make contact with classical general relativity. So is it possible that by adding conditions such as, I don't know, simplicity or something else, that one might actually be able to reduce this to SU2 and the boundary states? In other words, it may be that,
I think that the last formulation is really well put, because that's exactly what happens. We always get this universal boundary space that's larger, SO4, et cetera, et cetera. If we are in the EPRL case, we can use the EPRL map in order to connect to the SU2. So exactly by using the simplicity constraints, we connect to the SU2 picture. That's exactly what happens. Now here, the nice thing is that you can do that, and you can use the standard SU2 inner product and everything that, and the partition function still glues in a natural way, in the correct way. So you can use the SU2 inner product on the SU2 Hilbert space, et cetera, after taking the simplicity map in order to compose the partition function. It's this property that we lose. So that we would still go down to a subspace by using simplicity, but we would no longer, and we could even still go to an SU2 space, but then we could no longer in a natural way use the SU2 in a product to actually compose amplitudes.
Amplitudes in the bulk or amplitudes in the, amplitudes in order to compose amplitudes, so you have, if you are kind of too simplistic, two four simplices, and you're calculating the amplitude for one and for another. Is that what you're saying?
And then you want to, what we want is usually we want to put the condition that you take one complex, another complex, calculate the amplitude, you integrate over the boundary state, and you get the amplitude for one big complex. That's
right.
What I mean.
Right. So you're saying that somehow, somehow there's some new thing that is happening. That is, you could actually get the standard Hilbert space, except for the composition law. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a new thing, but it's a thing. I mean, Friedel Krasnov already doesn't connect to the. Actually, I should qualify that. I think this might be possible. I haven't actually looked at it, but I mean, this is in some sense Friedel Krasnov model, for example, does not go down to an SE2 boundary space. It goes down to a it reduces the SO4 space, but not to an SE2 space. At least not in a straightforward way.
Okay, I mean, I just feel that where to make contact with classical general relativity, and I mean, there's nothing sacred about loop quantum gravity in space, but we have to make contact with, I mean, not contact, but we have to show explicitly that we are not talking about, you know, transition amplitudes in some other theory which has more degrees of freedom. We have to say that we are talking about transition amplitudes in general relativity.
Well, if I go back to Friedel Krasnov, then the statement is, well, the transition amplitudes have the red reaction, which is the discrete Einstein-Hilbert action, and the boundary space has geometric interpretation as discretized boundary geometry. That's the same here. This boundary space carries information about discrete boundary geometry, and that's, I mean, just like in Barrett Princess, et cetera. In this game, I think this is the biggest connection we have. Our boundaries are the right boundaries for encoding three geometries on the boundary, and three connections and three geometries on the boundary.
Okay, I should stop because I we can go on. Maybe we can just talk on Skype or something.
Frank, I have a question. So is there a parameter that you're sending to infinity in your asymptotic analysis?
Yes, if you look back to the main statement on slide 12. It's the spin or the size of the spin or the size of the bivectors in the boundary. So the statement about the distribution is actually a statement that's irrespective of the boundary. So the statement of the wavefront set of the partition function, that's a general statement that doesn't require a boundary state in a way. So this is a statement about the distribution of support. However, for arbitrary boundary states, of course, the regular support of the partition function might well just be as important to the overall amplitude as the distributional support. It's only in the limit of large bivectors in the boundary that the distributional support dominates completely. Of course, I would hope that physically that just means large relative to the Planck scale, but mathematically, of course, I'm sending lambda to infinity. And Psi lambda is defined two slides earlier, actually, or not quite defined, but two slides earlier in slide 10, I'm writing out psi of g lambda p, where psi is peaked on g and lambda p. The lambda scales the bivectors that this state is peaked on.
Thank you.
More questions? Okay, let's thank Frank again.